You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where 2 + 2 equals 2 fewer championships than the New England Patriots have, and that's the only math that matters. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and the farce is coming so quickly and so furiously recently, I can't even keep up. I had to cut so many articles this week that it's unbelievable. I was literally sitting there. It took me so much longer than usual to do the outline because I was just like, I didn't know what stories to pick. I really didn't. That's how farcical this past week has been. And even better, we have a great guest for you this week, a great guest host. We got a great interview coming up. And this is the episode where if we want a cookie, we're going to eat a fucking cookie. Joining me this trip from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Greed.
Hello, hello. Yeah, I guess it's been a crazy week. I went to Vegas this weekend, and it was a friend's birthday. We rented a Airbnb with a hot tub, and man, it was great weather, not too hot in Vegas, which is really rare. Did wander around the casinos. It's sort of like not quite Fallout New Vegas, you know, people with masks wandering around. It very much reminded me of Fallout New Vegas, but, you know, people are out and about. It was not as dead as I thought it would be. People are out trying to have some fun, but Justin, talk about arbitrary rules. Some things being closed, other things not being closed. Surprisingly, I could have gotten a haircut on the strip. It was the first I was walking by and I saw an actual barbershop. I think it was at Cosmo. It was actually open. I was so tempted to get the overpriced haircut just because, you know, being here in California, it's like impossible to get haircuts right now. So, but unfortunately, my luscious locks are growing out still. I did not drop the money for the expensive haircut.
I finally got a haircut, and because I'm going back to school next week or in a couple weeks, we have like pre-planning where I think we just go in and they tell us bullshit for 2 weeks. But I finally got a haircut, and I went in and the guy didn't have a mask on, and I was like, "Do I have to put on a mask?" He's like, "Nah, I don't care." I was like, "Ah, Florida. That's why I moved here." William, is it weird being in Vegas knowing that Zack Snyder's post-apocalyptic movie Army of the Dead is also going to be in Vegas when it comes out?
I guess it's I think now would be the time to film it, right? I mean, you know, normally you have to like factor in all this time to get between places, and you know, it's actually was really easy to get around and to get to where you wanted to go. The one thing, though, I did notice, another friend of mine flew in for this, but he flew into here to L.A. When he flew in here to L.A., you know how they have that crazy parking lot set up for all the Lyft and stuff? Well, I guess the Lyft drivers, if you live too close to the airport now, they're pretty much just, like, not accepting rides. So I'm only maybe, like, 50 minutes from the airport. They were just, he literally sat at the airport for 45 minutes getting people, like matching with people on Lyft and then getting declined, matching, getting declined. So
in LA, Lyft has become Tinder?
It has. They're swiping left, dude. So, yeah, they only want the big rides.
All right. Let's bring in our other guest. Also joining us from the hipster capital of New York City, the author of Heroes, Legends, Champions, Why Heroism Matters, Andrew Bernstein.
It's good to be here, guys. You know, the kid from Brooklyn made it to the Twilight Zone now, or into the mid zone anyway. Some of your younger listeners may not recognize the music, but I'm old enough to remember the Twilight Zone TV series, and we are living in the Twilight Zone right now, aren't we? It's just gotten really crazy out there.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, part of the reason to do that intro is hopefully to get people to go back and watch The Twilight Zone. To me, that's one of the greatest examples of American art that's been made, mainstream entertainment. Unfortunately, nowadays, they probably know it because Jordan Peele, I don't know if you know who that is, Andy. Jordan Peele
has
rebooted
it. Yeah, I forget who he is.
He's the guy who did the race fear-mongering horror movies, Get Out and Us. And now he's rebooted now he has rebooted The Twilight Zone for CBS All Access. So that pretty much shows the state of our culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we can still have fun, right? We're still alive. We have freedom of speech still, so we make use of it and, you know, fight the good fight and have fun while doing it.
Well, and that's exactly what we do in the Midside here. So I think we have a lot of fun to get into because of all the insane news stories this week. So let's do it in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad.
Before we delve into some of the stories here, if you want to support us, you can always do so on Patreon. It's patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon. You can give as little or as much as you want per episode. And then a lot of you have switched over to our new Locals site. I assure you, Locals is not a dating site. It's a alternative to Patreon that was created if you're not comfortable giving money via Patreon because they take a cut. There it's a monthly subscription service. You can find that on themidside.com/locals or themidside.locals.com. The first story I wanted to go into this week, and this was one I thought about maybe cutting because we've seen something similar before where the guy was banned from the Chicago Cubs. I think it was a fan was banned from going to Chicago Cubs games because he gave the OK symbol and they said it was white power. So this was something similar, but because it was an athlete and because it's the Oakland Athletics, I wanted to go into this story a little bit too. So the headline of this story from Yahoo.com is A's bench coach apologizes for apparent post-game Nazi salute. And then he says it wasn't intentional. So here's a couple quotes from the article. Oakland Athletics bench coach Ryan Christensen found himself having some explaining to do after his team's 6-4 win on Thursday. Which, by the way, that quote just sounds like he has to explain why they actually dared to win a game.
How dare the Athletics win?
When video started circulating of him making a gesture that looked an awful lot like a Nazi salute. Key words here, looked an awful lot. Now, they're not saying it is a Nazi salute. He just has to explain because it looks like a Nazi salute. Christensen told A's beat reporter Susan Slusher, I think that's how you say it, I don't know, that A's general manager David Frost called him about the matter soon after the game and that he was not intentionally making a Nazi salute. He did acknowledge just how bad the video looked, though. Christensen then apologized and said he would know better than to make that gesture intentionally or not. William, this is another example of what I'm always talking about, where remember I said a while ago, it was even during the Hillary campaign, during her debates, the Hillary Clinton campaign during her debates, where they're trying to make externalities, the idea that in economics, the unintentional consequences of your actions, they're trying to make that into a thing for all of us morally now. We've talked about this with Corona, with, oh, well, you could potentially get someone sick, so you have to fucking wear a hazmat suit when you go outside. It's the same thing here. If someone can freeze frame a gesture you do and it looks offensive to one person, you're fucked.
I might, you know, I tend to sleep with my my arms in weird positions. Maybe I've unintentionally, during my sleep, made a Nazi salute. I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty insane, guys. There are people who are like professionally aggrieved persons. You know, they're like offended almost for a living. And you can't, you see it a lot with ethnic humor, other than, you know, late nights in Las Vegas. You know, if you do ethnic humor now, you are, you know, you're a racist. And it's really absurd. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, for us who support freedom of speech, we need to stand up, you know, and vocally, attack this politically correct mentality and also stand up for the right to do ethnic humor. I mean, ethnic humor in some context can be really fun and funny, you know, and we don't want to throw that out just because some people are professionally offended.
Yeah. Was I the only one that's when I saw this story thought that maybe somehow the Oakland Athletics, the name needed to be changed? I mean, that seems to be like the only thing going on in sports right now is changing all the team names. So, like, what?
It is offensive, William, that you would say that people have to be more athletic to play professional sports. How dare you say
that's ableism.
That there's I think we have ableism.
I think maybe we should contact the Babylon Bee and get a nice farcical article written on it. Woke
and
or
even
joke.
The Oakland A's, that comes first in the alphabet. Why are we privileging order in the name?
Yeah. Well, maybe A's is some kind of hidden white power salute. I don't know if the OK symbol can be appropriated by racists. Maybe the A's can also, so they need to change their name. I mean, it's
It must be because in the education system, you get an A if you have the best grade. So then that has to just be getting recognized, getting deemed excellent by the white power system. So A must mean white power approves of you.
Yeah, you're right, Justin. And according to some of the gangster mentality, some of the black thugs in the hood, I could see a lot of black Americans don't subscribe to that because there's a lot of well-educated, affluent black Americans. But in the hood, like that gangster mentality is, reading books and everything. It's not only unmanly, but it's acting white. Getting an education is only for whites or Asians. It's not for the black man. Black man's supposed to be a gangster. And could anybody be more racist than that? To say that, education's not for blacks. The Jim Crow crackers, held that view. They were racist as hell and they were moral monsters. Well, so are the gangsters in the hood, and we need to be talking about that anti-education mentality that's holding back a lot of black Americans, and that's, is partially responsible for the unbelievable homicide rate in some of the black urban neighborhoods.
And that, I think, is the most farcical thing you've just said about this story is we see things through this lens so much that we're holding everyone back. Because if you can't freely express yourself, you can't discuss these ideas and you can't discuss these issues. You said earlier about the whole ethnic humor thing. Well, even what you just said, people might be offended by that you were differentiating between, the black thugs in the hood and the educated black people. They would even have problems with that because we're seeing everything through this lens of, oh, what could be offensive and what could, not see people as, their group being what's the most important thing about them.
Yeah, you're right. And you're right about that, Justin and William. And if we really do sincerely care about black lives, as we should, because all lives matter, including black lives, that the real danger to the black lives are the gangbangers, the urban terrorists, as Tlaib Stalks calls them, who murder 90% of black murder victims. We can't talk about it. You and I will be called, the three of us, we're white, we'll be called racists. And black conservatives will be called worse. They'll be race traitors and sellouts and coons, and stuff. We can't talk about the issues. We're being suppressed. Consequently, how are we going to do anything to save black lives, 90% of whom are killed not by whites or Asians or Latinos, and certainly not by the police officers, but by black thugs in the hood? We can't talk about it. The problem, which is a real life and death problem, gets swept under the rug. And you're right. We can't address it. We can't, find any solutions.
Yeah. And the other term I hear about these black people you're talking about is I see it with Zuby on Twitter. He's this very well-educated black man from England, went to Oxford. He's an entrepreneur, musician. They call him a grifter all the time. Oh, you're a grifter. You're just pandering to these people to get money from them. You don't really believe in individualism and freedom and everything and capitalism. That you're just a grifter. But all your points, I think, lead into the next article, the next story perfectly. And I think this is a big news thing that wasn't really covered. I mean, part of the farce of this next story is this was not covered because what Andy was just talking about, what you were just talking about, Andy, it's so important in this next story, the subtlety and the context of what happened. So the Daily Mail, the UK site, it had an exclusive. Police body cam footage shows moment-by-moment arrest of George Floyd for the first time. So this footage showed what happened before the cop kneeled on his neck for 8 minutes, right? Before the cop did that. Now, before we even start, I want to say, obviously, I am not justifying kneeling on anyone's neck for 8 minutes. Nothing that happened beforehand justifies that. But we can't look at things so simplistically. That doesn't mean George Floyd was completely innocent, and it doesn't mean everything he did made rational sense. I think actually what Andy just said contributed largely to what happened in this situation. I think it contributed to the specific situation, and I think it contributed to the overall culture of our country that leads to situations like this occurring. So, some quotes from the article. Transcripts from the videos were released in mid-July, but a judge in Minneapolis had ruled the video could only be viewed in the courthouse, meaning few people have had the chance to watch the powerful images. But the footage has now been leaked to DailyMail.com, so the world can finally see the tragedy of Floyd's last minutes as the cops were mindless of Floyd's anguish. By the way, I love the bias of the way that's written. Right? Do you believe that he had anguish? Final quote. This footage includes more than 18 minutes from Officer Alex Coons, I don't know how to say that, body cam, and 10 minutes from Officer Thomas Lane. So, Andy, it sounds like you have something you want to say. It's interesting to me that they frame it as the last minutes of the cops were mindless of Floyd's anguish, because I've seen lots of videos recently of black people being arrested and they immediately just start crying that they're being abused and suffering. And it seems to me as a way of trying to get out of being arrested.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of things, you know, to a number of points to be made here, Justin, William. First of all, your preface is right. Derek Chauvin should not have kneeled on this dude's neck for 8 seconds, never mind 8 minutes. By that time, they had him subdued. And then, you know, there's a bunch of cops there. They could have gotten them into the car and taken them downtown. And by the way, they do this to white criminals sometimes, too. If you've seen the footage, what was his name, Tony Timpa in Dallas, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. It's up on the Internet. It's also hard to watch. The cop was kneeling on his back. You know, I don't know. It killed him. I don't know what Tony Timpa died of, but it might have been his lungs were being pressed into the ground by the cop, you know, having all his weight on Tony Timpa's back. And he died. Tony Timpa was a white dude. He was in Dallas, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. But yeah, George Floyd was a criminal. He didn't deserve to die, but you know, you can't talk about the black crime rate in this country, you know, without being called a racist, or if you're black, you'll be called worse, you know, if you talk about it. And yet this is an example, Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis, without a doubt, an example of police brutality. It's murder. I think everybody agrees on that. And may well be racist. I don't know if Chauvin would have done it to a white criminal, but you know, the cops in Dallas did to Tony Timpa, so it's possible. But it's definitely police brutality. But you know, you can't talk about the black crime rate that's so off the charts. Like I said, 90% of black homicide victims are murdered by blacks. And we, you know, that's the real threat to black lives. And we can't talk about it. You know, we'll be called racists, or black conservatives will be called worse. So, yeah, the suppression of free speech here is deadly. And then it leads to the insanity of defund the police. If it were up to me, we would defund the Democratic Party. We would defund the criminals. And we would defund Black Lives Matter and defund Antifa, you know, these leftist terrorist organizations. Defund the police. The worst victims of that are going to be honest black men, women, and children who live in the high crime areas. And by the way, I saw a Gallup poll report, Justin, William, you might be interested. Saw this the other day. 80% of black Americans, of the ones polled, and they had the margin of error was like 1.5 to 2%. 81% of the black Americans polled wanted at least as much policing as they currently have or more. Only 19% wanted less. So, I mean, it shows, you know, every man and every woman amongst the black American community have much greater sanity than do white leftist intellectuals. So, yeah, we could go on talking about this for a long time, couldn't we?
Yeah. I think there's two things that jump out at me about this story. Like, first of all, Justin, you already hinted at it. The framing, right? Just the way it's framed, the headline, oh my God, the bias just throughout it. It's crazy. I wonder how many people didn't even bother to watch the video, because if you watch the video, what you see is clearly someone who is on drugs reacting incredibly strangely to the police, right? They ask him initially to to show his hands. He doesn't show his hands. And so the officer pulls his gun, which is standard procedure for officers in that sort of situation. And of course, what does the Daily Mail do? And all these other news agencies, they clip at a very odd angle the person holding the gun at the suspect, right? And in order to sort of like show, well, yeah, clearly, see, they pulled a gun on him. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, but the context, if you take that out, the fact that they couldn't see his hands and he wasn't being repeatedly asked to show his hands and would not show his hands, it makes a little more sense, right? Like, you put this in context, it makes more sense. You know, we combine this video with the toxicology report. You know, he was on uppers and downers, right? And had like something like six different substances going through his body. Like, okay, this guy was tripping, right? Like he was having basically a panic attack, right? You know, drug-induced panic attack, and was complaining about not being able to breathe before they even got him to the cop car to put him in. So again, not this is like you said before, Justin. This is not saying that he deserved to have a knee on his neck for 8 minutes, right? Like that is not what's going on here. But certainly, you look at this and you say, well, the prosecutor's fucked up here because they charge him with attempted murder, right? And with murder, right? And aiding murder, whatever the murder charges were. That's watching this video. These cops are going to get off, not be held accountable because the prosecutor has completely overcharged them.
Right, and that's the thing with what Andy said and what you said and watching the video leads to the culture getting worse. Because when I see this video and when I see everything that happened, I see multiple things wrong with our culture. But instead of addressing all of them, and you and Andy addressed them both so well, instead of addressing all of those, we just go down this collectivist route. And instead we get violence. We get riots. We get Antifa basically trying to destroy Portland, right? We had Andy Ngo, wasn't it this past week he was in Congress, William?
Yeah. Reporter Andy Ngo. Senate hearings. Basically, his beat is Antifa, is what he likes to say. And I think that's a good way to summarize it.
Well, he's from Portland, right?
Yeah. Well, he was covering last night. They firebombed the police union building again. So that's not being widely covered, right? The only one I get information on is from Andy Ngo's Twitter feed.
Right. Because instead of looking at this situation and say, hey, what are all the things that are contributing to this? Instead, we make it this collectivist racist thing where that's all it is. That's the only lens we can look at this in. And if you're against it,
if you don't follow the narrative exactly as prescribed, then clearly you're the enemy, right?
Correct.
To bring in these nuances and context, that is unacceptable.
Perfect.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you guys are doing a good thing here. You're showing the farcical nature of some of this stuff. Could anything be more farcical than a defund the police mentality? I mean, what is that? That's criminals lib, right? I mean, let's right? That's what it is. It's criminals lib. Let's let criminals run loose, whether they're white, black, Asian, Latino, whatever, you know, biracial. Just let them run loose. But, you know, the mentality that some of these leftists have, that the police presence in the hood is responsible for the high crime rate, you know, the off the charts homicide rate in so many of the black. You go, what? The police? If that were the case, you know, the drug dealing gangs who war on each other would be warring on the police. They'd be, you know, they'd be drive by shooting up the police stations and everything, but they war on each other. Is not if you withdraw the police or defund the police, then obviously there's less, you know, suppression of criminal gangs, and they're going to war on each other even more. I mean, you, Justin, William, you can't make this stuff up. Defund the police, you know, as some way to deal with the crime rate. I mean, it's just insanity. Only modern white American Marxist intellectuals could, and some are non-white, but you know, a lot of them are white, native-born, male, you know, American Marxist intellectuals come up with this kind of. It's insane. It's absolute insanity. Even to discuss it for a second, And I'll tell you, if you want to do something constructive, let's defund the public schools, which are a shambles and are largely responsible for, you know, for this mess in a number of ways. But we need to refund the police. Do we need to reform the police in some way? There's police brutality. Yeah, we need to reform the police. But the idea to defund the police and minimize the police presence is just insane. It's just going to let the criminals run loose. It's truly a farce in and of itself. You can't make this stuff up. If you wrote it in a novel 10 years ago, you know, that there would be a defund the police movement, people couldn't take it seriously.
So, Andy, we occasionally on the show, we play this game called Woke or Joke, where we read a headline and we try to determine whether it's written by The Onion or the Babylon Bee or if it's a real news article. Well, I had one show up, and this one, unfortunately, is real. Teen Vogue. While we're working to abolish the police, we must also work to dismantle what the police were put here to protect, property.
Well, there's a good Marxist line.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what they're after, right? Like, why hide it?
Absolutely. Yeah, no. Several of the founders of Black Lives Matter said publicly, we are trained Marxists. With Antifa, it couldn't be any clearer. That they're, you know, here's a subject for farce for you guys. Even if they were accurate, that they were anti-fascist, what good is it if you're communists? You know, it's like Richard Spencer and Jared Taylor and those, you know, leaders of the so-called alt-right who want a white ethno state, you know, and the non-whites got to be kicked out so they wouldn't have Thomas Sowell or Walter Williams or Candace Owens or Larry Elder. All these great black heroes wouldn't be allowed in the white ethno state. So they're basically, they're neo-Nazis. So let's say they started an organization, anti-com. You know, we're anti-communists. Well, fine. What good is it if you're Nazis? You know? And that's what Antifa is. They're a communist terrorist organization with may or may not be opposed to fascism. Probably not. But they're a totalitarian manifestation. Want to abolish property. You know, Black Lives Matter and Antifa, they're mirror organizations in black and in white. They're communist terrorist organizations. And BLM says they want to wipe out the nuclear family, right? Replace the nuclear family with the state. They want to abolish property. Yeah. Yeah, they abolish the police so the terrorists can run loose in the streets. I don't know how honest people can miss it. How there are still honest people who think these are Black Lives Matters, you know, fighting for a noble cause, and they put money into BLM and they support BLM. I don't know how they can miss that. There's a Black Lives Matter and Antifa are Marxist terrorist organizations. I don't know how anybody can miss it.
Well, it's like you said about the public education system is people aren't taught to think critically and they're not taught to think beyond the surface level. And if you look at the surface level of Black Lives Matter and you look at the surface level of Antifa, anti-fascist, you hear that and you go, oh, yeah, I think Black Lives Matter. And oh, yeah, I think, you know, fascism is bad. I'm anti-fascist. And then the people on the streets, and the streets include nowadays social media, who are in favor of these things will continue to say, well, how can you not support anti-fascism? Aren't you fascist then? If you don't support Antifa, you're fascist. It's they've completely won the rhetorical game because of their branding. And it's like you pointed out 100%, and we've been saying this for years. We've been saying this since, you know, we had friends who were victims at Berkeley at the Milo Yiannopoulos riots about how Antifa is pro-fascist because communism ultimately devolves into fascism. There's no way around that in reality. So all your points are very well taken, and it's very much a rhetorical game. That's all it is at this point.
You're right. And, you know, since, you know, I teach philosophy in universities, I'm on the front lines. At least I was until early March when they shut down the front lines and everything went online. But, you know, I've been on the front lines for years and I can see the decline. It's really sad. A lot of these kids are good kids, but a number of them, you know, as a college, 18, 19, 20-year-old college kids, struggle just with the mechanics of reading. The schools have gotten away from phonics. They reject phonics. They use some variation of the whole word method, which doesn't work. These kids struggle just to read. I used to use Ayn Rand's novel, The Fountainhead, in my ethics classes for years. I can't have them read The Fountainhead anymore. They can't read it, never mind understand it. And so you're right, Justin. When they can't read and they don't know the first thing about American history, I had 10 of 20 students in the spring 10 of 20, 50% of the class never heard of James Madison. They never heard of him. They never heard of the guy who wrote the Bill of Rights. They don't know the first thing about American history, and they struggle just to read. The reading comprehension obviously is poor. Then they have no critical abilities, or very few critical abilities, with which to analyze Antifa and Black Lives Matter and see who they really are. And it's done deliberately. Going back to John Dewey and the progressives, they've deliberately stunted the American education system to stunt the minds of these kids. And, you know, they were, John Dewey and all those guys, pilgrimage to the Soviet Union, you know, they admired communism, and, you know, this communism is what they want. And they've done a good job of stunting the minds of American kids so that they can't critically examine these communist terrorist organizations. It's heartbreaking. It really is. It's really sad and scary.
It's scary when you see them on these platforms, and this transitions perfectly, like TikTok, making videos supporting these organizations. And that's why the next story is so interesting and so farcical to me, because I'm going to be honest, I'm not even clear on this next story. Trump issues orders banning TikTok and WeChat from operating in 45 days if they are not sold by Chinese parent companies. So I'm not 100% clear on this story. I'm going to read a couple quotes, and then William, I'm going to throw it to you first, because I think, and I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about, but I think you're more familiar with this. I think this affects you more directly in certain ways, so you might have more knowledge of it. So the article says, the order regarding TikTok prohibits after 45 days any transaction by any person or with respect to any property subject to the jurisdiction of the United States with ByteDance Limited, the Chinese company that owns the social media platform. Microsoft said Sunday that it was pushing forward with talks to acquire the app following a conversation between CEO Satya Nadella and the president. On Monday, Trump set September 15 as the deadline for TikTok to find a U.S. buyer. Failing to do so, he said, would lead him to shut down the app in the country. In an unusual declaration, Trump also said any deal would have to include a substantial amount of money coming to the U.S. Treasury. Here's my thing. Right now, we see the issues with our relationship with China in the world. We see the controversy with the NBA and their relationship with China, right? They're talking about farce. They write Black Lives Matter on their course. They have jerseys that say freedom, love us, education reform, not one more, things like that. And then they do business with China, who's committing genocide. And they have basically basketball camps where they're committing abuse against Chinese citizens. And then we see, as we were just talking about in the last story, how detrimental TikTok is culturally. What these kids are posting about, how it's just, you know, we saw the girl who graduated from Harvard. It was a TikTok video that she lost her job at Deloitte & Touche because she made the joke about all cuts matter, that, you know, when she was trying to make fun of the All Lives Matter statement. But on the other hand, William, freedom of speech, how do you prevent a company from operating? How do you prevent people from saying what they want? And then isn't it extortion to be like, if you're going to make this deal, you have to give us a shitload of money? Like, if the mob did that, like, that would be extortion. Why, when the government does it, is it not extortion? There's just so much in this story.
Yeah, it's really difficult to navigate. And now's a good time to put the disclaimer. This is my personal views, not with any other relationships I have with any other groups. This one is particularly hard because I don't even understand where the authority really comes from on this. But it's further complicated because, you know, we talk about having a mixed economy here in the United States. China, there's no mixed, right? Like, everything is controlled by the state. So you have to like factor that in. It makes this really complicated. You know, when we talk about enforcing things like United States contract rights and property laws on a Chinese company, that's traditionally been almost impossible, right? Like, the whole 80s and 90s was replete with, you know, just rampant stepping on intellectual property rights in China, right? And so when we talk about privacy, right, something was so, when we're talking about social media, but the privacy laws are really important. I think the concern is, well, hey, they're just not going to respect it, right? Like, they're just, there's no reason for them to respect any privacy. So I, in a way, I'm sort of sympathetic in that way, right? Where we're saying, hey, there's no way for us to enforce the law on these on this Chinese company. So we're just saying no. But then, yeah, but then you see how they're going about it. It seems very, very mafia, right? This is a very much a mafia move.
You know, let me say something, because I'm a low tech guy, and I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with the technical details here. So let me put it hypothetically. I think if some company in trading with a totalitarian state, whether it was Hitler's regime or Stalin's or Mao or the current, you know, Chinese murderers, if some company trading with a totalitarian regime is aiding the trade is aiding their military buildup and or their intelligence surveillance to be able the government, U.S. government, if they could objectively establish that in a court of law, then I think they do have the authority to curtail free trade here, you know, and put an end to an American company dealing with a totalitarian regime in that regard. But I don't know if the U.S. government has that kind of evidence and or if they've, you know, if they could establish that, in which case I don't think they have any moral authority and shouldn't have any legal authority to restrict private companies trading, you know, with China.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It wasn't just TikTok. I think the next day Trump put out for WeChat, which is a social media platform primarily used in China, but it's available worldwide. And certainly we know objectively that WeChat is used by China to surveil Chinese citizens. Like that's 100%. Like all the group messages and everything in WeChat, those are all readable by the PRC. So at least for that one, it makes more sense, right? It at least makes more sense to me. But again, like you said, without this going through some sort of court process, there's no way for us to bring that objectivity to it and say, okay, this thing is the evil, and so we're just not going to allow this. We're not allowing people to trade with this company because they are doing this thing.
Yeah, and the analogy with Hitler's regime is always a good one, because the Nazis made no, they didn't hide who they were. They were the master race, and they were they had the rightful authority to conquer, enslave, and or annihilate, you know, so-called inferior races. That was clearly their goal. They were building up their military for years. And so if some American, you know, Ford Motor Company, let's say, for example, was building a heavy truck factory in Germany, and it was clear the Nazis converted that into making tanks, you know, then I think you can, and you have the evidence, you prove it in a court of law, I think the U.S. government would have the authority to say, no, you can't do that. It's dangerous to the free countries surrounding or the freer countries anyway, surrounding Nazi Germany. And in the end, it could be dangerous to us, could get us sucked into the war and threaten the lives of thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans. Yeah. So I think under those circumstances, it makes sense. But other than that, if you can't establish objectively in a court of law that this company's trade with the regime militarily or the intelligence networks threatens the lives and privacy and well-being of U.S. citizens, then I don't think you have the authority to curtail that kind of free trade.
Yeah, again, that's why I think the WeChat one makes a little more sense. The PRC uses WeChat to track Chinese citizens on American soil, like when they send students to college here. They use the WeChat. They basically read all the chat messages that the student sends, and if they get out of line, they will threaten their family. And this is well documented, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't doubt anything you tell me about what communists do. So I go, yeah, it makes sense to me in such a case to disassociate yourself from such a viciously evil a practice like that.
Yep.
What would be the proper process? Because these are just executive orders Trump is issuing, right?
Yeah, they're just executive orders. Like I said, I'm a little leery of the process, right? Like this gets back to something we've talked about before, you know, Congress just kind of like being derelict in its duty, just giving all this authority over to the executive branch through administrative law. This seems like an administrative law action, which is even in the order itself, it's like, well, the Commerce Secretary or whoever he delegates is going to determine these things, right? And it's pretty crazy, right? And 45 days, this is all supposed to happen. And, you know, now you have a fire sale on TikTok. And I mean, there's no way that WeChat could be separated from its parent company. It's like an integral part. It'd be like, It'd be like telling Google that they have to separate from Android, right? Like it's just not possible, right?
I'm sorry, real quickly, the point about, you know, you sell this to Microsoft, let's say, and then the government's got to get a cut. That is extortion. I mean, under certain circumstances, the government has the right to curtail, you know, the free trade is not an absolute. You don't want to trade with totalitarian states that militarily threaten you, you know, and build up those states. But the government doesn't get a cut of any, you know, you can't force the private companies to give you a cut of any money you make in the sale. You're absolutely right, Justin. That's extortion.
Yeah, and that's what the point I was building towards, not the extortion point in particular, but even this past week, we saw Trump issue more executive orders. So the growth in government is insane here. It's under the auspices of national security, but it's just growing government to such an extreme degree. And that's where I get annoyed when people think the right and the left are any different in this country anymore. I mean, if you weren't told that Trump was a Republican, you would have no way of knowing who he actually was, what he actually stood for. Because is this any different than
anything Obama? Well, he's standing up to China, so maybe that would give it away. But other than that,
maybe. All right. And when we're talking about fascism, I think that leads perfectly into our last story, right? The growth of government. Mayor Eric Garcetti says the Department of Water and Power will shut off water and power at homes that throw large parties. Now, this article I've linked to, you can see all the articles on themidside.com/podcast. Just click on any episode link. You can read the articles there. This article is from Deadline, because when I Googled this story, the most objective source I could find was Deadline, a Hollywood news source. I'm getting better news about what's going on in the world in California from the entertainment news sites than I am things like the LA Times. That's insane in itself. So what this article says is, if the LAPD responds to repeated complaints and verifies that there have been violations at a home, the city will within 48 hours have the DWP shut off service at that home. Garcetti also indicated that county health inspectors and other city representatives would be on the lookout for violations. He said that city legal experts had vetted the measure and found it on firm legal ground. Who are these experts? We could actually do the power or water shut off after a first violation, said the mayor, but we like to educate, not enforce. What the... That is, I keep pointing out, right? Remember I went on the rant, I don't know, like a couple months ago about like Gavin Newsom's scary statement of, you know, we believe in science, not politics or whatever he said. Yeah, and it was just how scary that was. This is scary as fuck. We like to educate, not enforce. So it's like, you are going to get in line and agree with what we say and you're going to be indoctrinated, or we're going to take away your water and your power. We're going to take away your basic life essentials if you do not agree with the party indoctrination. It's fucking terrifying, William.
Yeah, it is. And notice also, there's no defund the police sentiment here, as long as the police are put in service of, you know, of a government power grab, right? The LAPD's repeatedly called to a place, okay, you know, proper function of police is to help the government suppress parties and cut off water supply of innocent people. Proper function of police is not to suppress criminals. It's terrifying.
Yeah, the firm legal ground to say if you violate an order, we can shut off your water and power. I'm really interested to hear that firm legal ground. You know, Justin, Andy, you might not know this. One of the many things I do, I own a restaurant. We get our occasional visitors by the health inspectors. Well, we've got, of course, because of COVID, they finally got around to coming to us post COVID. They have a, you know, long list of recommendations, you know, to me, it's a little weird because, you know, we've been operating the whole time and, you know, following all this guidance, working with our franchise to, you know, make sure we're keeping our customers and our employees safe. And then they basically just come in and give us some very vapid recommendations, you know, talking about, encouraging our employees to stand 6 feet apart when they basically work on a line. Like, a, you know, like I can't make the fact that the grill is so many feet from the slicer is just the way the restaurant is, right? And and forgetting that, you know, our goal here is to operate safely, right? And knowing that they could just decide arbitrarily, well, you know, your slicer is too close to your grill, so you can't stand 6 feet apart, so we're just going to close it, right? Like,
William, to interrupt real quickly, just turn it back on them. Say, well, maybe if you'd lower all the fucking taxes and fees, I could afford property that wasn't so goddamn expensive, and I could have more space in between my stuff in my restaurant.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure they'd listen to that argument. But, but imagine them coming in and saying, if you don't follow this, you know, we're going to shut off the water or the power, right? Like, it's the same thing, right? This is treating, to me, it's unique because it's treating people, homeowners, like they treat us businessmen. So, I don't know. I don't know if there's really anything to say other than, like, this is, seems like a little bit of a shift.
But also the point that Justin made before about educating, you know, that's what the communists are notorious for, their re-education camps. You know, they where they indoctrinate you in, you know, in Marxist theory, and they try and beat any bourgeois beliefs, that is beliefs in individualism, individual rights and freedom, you know, out of you. And yeah, that's what this type of education is. We're gonna educate you or train you to realize you have to obey the state in all things, regardless how arbitrary or just, you know, dishonest and immoral the state's decrees are. So, yeah, this would be re-education. We prefer to re-educate rather than to turn off your water. But if you're not successful in indoctrinating you, then we'll turn off the necessities of life. We are moving into closer and closer towards dictatorship. And what you said before, Justin, is true. It doesn't matter whether it comes from the right or the left. Those distinctions are getting very blurred in our day. But we're being pushed towards dictatorship without a doubt.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head furiously out of everything you just said, overall, everything you just said, because that's exactly what I hear when I hear this. I just hear a communist dictator. I really do. I really do. I know most people don't see that. But when you sit there and you go educate, not enforce, how is that ever okay for a politician to say? How do people not? I mean, you want to talk about riots? People are rioting over a bunch of other stuff. But how are people not rioting because the fucking mayor of their city said educate, not enforce? Like, that's such a failure of our culture that people don't hear that and immediately go, what the fuck? Fuck this guy.
Yeah, I would rather to bring it back to me, I'd rather the inspector come in with some objective rules and some objective guidelines instead of, you know, educating me, right? That's actually helpful, and I don't have to agree with them, right? But there's this insidious concept of you must agree, right? It's not that you follow the rules, right, or obey the law. You must believe. And there's that educate, not enforce. That's what that comes down to. They don't want compliance, right? They want belief. They want acceptance. They want you to be in it.
Even stronger than that, William, I think they want fear. And I don't want to go into like specifics here because I don't want to like sell anyone out. But I heard a story of someone who doesn't live in LA proper, lives in one of the cities outside of it, and you know everything's LA, right? I mean, even Anaheim's considered LA, even though it's Orange County. But in a city around there, where they call, this is so insane. This person called the local police department because there was going to be a family gathering at a place, and they were like, "What? Do you follow the same rule that Eric Garcetti said? Would you shut us off if we got in trouble?" And the police were, this is how sometimes I have a little bit of hope. The police were like, why are you snitching on yourself, basically? Because this is, first of all, it's scary because this person's so afraid the person was snitching on himself, right? I guess I just gave the gender, oh well. But then the police aren't too far gone where I think there are a lot more rational people out there who don't want to do this and are feeling like they're forced to do this too. So it's a funny story because in a terrifying story, because one, it shows someone so afraid, but two, it shows that other people are like, why are you fucking making this an issue? Just stay out of trouble. Like, it's just insane.
Yeah, all right. I mean, a lot of this, you can't make this stuff up, you know? What's happened in the past, since February, March, with the hysteria over the virus and then the riots over the murder of George Floyd. You know, if we had written this up, you know, in fiction a few years ago, as that this was what was coming, I don't think a lot of us would have believed it. It is so insane. It is so beyond the pale. It's really terrifying to me what they're doing to our country. It's just really sad.
Well said, and that's a good note to end on. And I think it's a good note to transition into, how do we get out of this? How do we move on from this? And I think something you've written recently, Andy, will help us do that. So let's talk about it in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. As always, if you want to continue the conversation with us during the week, see some of the articles we're considering, or if you want to listen in live when we're recording this on Sundays, you guys get these episodes on Mondays. We record them on Sundays. You can always join our Discord. The link is available on any episode site at themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. So one of the reasons we wanted to bring Andy on is we wanted to talk about his new book. His new book is called Heroes, Legends, Champions, Why Heroism Matters. So
here's a copy of it, Justin. Can you see it?
Oh, I can see it, Justin. Can't. Yeah, it looks beautiful.
I don't have my video up.
Yeah, well, I'm, if people can see it, I'm holding up the cover. It's got that great painting from the great Brian Lawson, who's a brilliant painter on the cover. So
yeah, we'll put that in the show notes so people can people who listen in, they'll be able to see it.
Yeah, thank you, William. And it's available from Amazon, of course. So, you know, it's only like $15. It's inexpensive.
So sorry, why don't you just... Yeah, no, you're good. I mean, that was perfect. why don't you just start with talking about what it's about? What, you know, give a brief synopsis and what inspired you to write it. I think that's the big thing right now. I mean, I know you love, you know, that's what you're all about in general. I mean, one of the things I identify you with is... You just have this indomitable positive spirit about heroism. But why now? Why not? I mean, why not earlier in your life? Why now?
Well, first of all, I've been a hero worshiper all my life, and I grew up in a crazy family. I mean, a lot of us, and the world is a crazy place. There's a lot of good people, a lot of good things, but there's so much insanity. You know, I'm a Cold War kid, you know, baby boomer. Yeah, and communism was dangerous. I mean, it still is. But I mean, the Soviet Union was dangerous. I grew up in a scary world, you know, so on and so forth. So I was always a hero worshiper. You know, I didn't get much guidance from mom and dad, who both were, you know, wacky in their own ways. But, you know, so I weaned myself on heroes. And notice, you know, and a lot of the great people who've done great things, whether it was George Washington. You know, now, you know, we always have to acknowledge he was a slave owner. We deplore that. But we don't celebrate Washington for being a slave owner. We celebrate him for the indispensable contribution he made to winning the War of Independence and founding the American Republic, you know, the greatest country in history, the freest country in history. And you know, all these great heroes, whether it was Aristotle, or Isaac Newton, or some of the heroes I discussed in the book, Maria Montessori, the great educator, George Washington Carver, you know, the great agricultural scientist, Ernest Shackleton, the Antarctic explorer. You know, these heroes have done all these great things that, you know, that can inspire us to be the best version of ourselves. And yet we live in this anti-hero culture, you know, where heroes are often, you know, we like to tear down the icons, literally, these days. Tear down the statues. Got to find feet of clay. People, God forbid, people might be great. They might rise above, you know, the rest of us. We, you know, we live in this culture that celebrates mediocrity. You know, you look at serious art. You know, the novels and movies are all often about drug addicts or people who are, you know, they're crushed by their families or they're crushed by the capitalist system, you know, or whatever. So we live in this anti-hero culture. I wanted to revive the purpose of the book is to, you know, to resuscitate the idea that human beings can be heroes. There are heroes, that life requires heroes. And, you know, and in answer to your question, Justin, two things. We need heroes because, one, of the practical advances they make. Then George Washington and Madison and Jefferson, yes, they were slave owners, and we deplore that. But they established the freest country of history. The founding principle of individual rights should properly be applied to all human beings, both genders, any race, tribe, nationality, protect individual rights. This is what's morally right. This is the founding principle of our country. Heroes have done great things, you know, whether it was, you know, Louis Pasteur, who identified the germ theory of disease and made it possible for us to cure all these diseases. So one, in practical terms, heroes improve human life dramatically. And two, the inspirational value they have, you know, they will often overcome these daunting obstacles to reach these great life-giving achievements. And we could be inspired by that to do the same in our lives, to be the best version of ourselves. You know, if Shackleton and his crew can overcome these incredible obstacles to survive, you know, that would have been a disaster in the Antarctic, you know, crossing the ocean in storms and bit of cold and then climbing these snow-covered mountain peaks to get to a whaling station and get to safety. If they can overcome these incredible obstacles, you know, and for me, who wants to start my own business or write a book or rear a family of healthy children, I don't face these life-threatening dangers. What might I accomplish in my life? The heroes also give us great inspirational value. So for both reasons, I wanted to write this book.
Yeah, I think that's all very well said, and something that really struck a note with me, resonated with me, and something we actually talk about in this segment a lot, is what you said about all the movies that come out nowadays. We always talk about naturalism and how you look at anything that's considered good. It's just all of these naturalistic movies. I mean, what was Moonlight? It was wasn't that about the guy who was the homosexual drug addict criminal? Right. And that won the best picture. So it's always movies like that. I mean, we have such an obsession with naturalism. So I think it's very well taken. You named a bunch of different, you know, very heroic figures. Are those all your personal heroes that you were listing, or do you have any specific heroes that really inspire you in your life?
Well, I have a number of, you know, of heroes. I think Ayn Rand is a great hero. I think The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged are the two greatest novels ever written. I think objectivism revolutionizes our understanding of philosophy. I think she overcame unbelievable obstacles. The whole intellectual establishment was opposed to her, you know, to reach great intellectual and commercial success. So she's a woman, you know, who struggled against all these obstacles to do these things. So she's a personal hero of mine. Aristotle's a personal hero. I mean, I teach philosophy, so you can see why these philosophers and writers are my personal heroes. But Aristotle, who more than anybody taught human beings how to think, not only tried to anyway, she showed us how to do it, if some of us don't actually, you know, understand it. But, you know, he developed the principles of logic, you know, and above all, showed that logical thinking should be about observable fact. Not about mythology, not about, you know, faith-based belief, not about fantasies, but knowledge is gained by thinking logically in a non-contradictory way about observed facts. So Aristotle, you know, is a great hero. Mind you, George Washington I have this discussion with Brad Thompson a lot, who you know well, Justin, you know, who's an expert in the America's revolutionary period, especially, you know, John Adams. Now, I think, to me, Washington is the single most important figure in the founding of the greatest country in history. So, you know, these are some of my heroes, but there are many people I greatly admire. And by the way, some of them are in the field of sports. You know, I know you're a Boston guy. In the 1980s, I loved Larry Bird. I mean, he was at that time, he was the greatest player I'd ever seen. And I loved Bird, and I watched the Celtics, you know, rooted for the Celtics a lot. After he
you can come back whenever you want on the show. You can come back whenever
yeah,
you want.
Yeah. Well, wait. After the next thing I say, you may rescind that. Because after Bird retired and Michael Jordan rose to be the greatest player I ever saw, you know, I rooted for Michael Jordan and the Bulls a lot. Because, you know, these guys are heroes in a way. It's not just that they're born with great talent. It's that you have to have a tremendous work ethic to be the GOAT. You know, the greatest of all time. And I do think Michael Jordan is the GOAT. It takes a tremendous work ethic. You know, they used to say that MJ was the hardest working superstar in the NBA, and I think Larry Bird was too in the 80s. You know, these guys just put tremendous work ethic in. So I may not have the talent of a Bird or a Jordan in my own field, but I have, you know, as a writer, but I or an Ayn Rand. I think Ayn Rand is the GOAT, you know, the greatest of all time as a novelist. But I have some degree of talent, and talent can be cultivated. It can be developed by hard work. And what if I have the work ethic that Larry Bird, you know, Michael Jordan had? You know, how high might I rise? So I have a lot of admiration for sports heroes.
Yeah, and when you talk about sports and you talk about work ethic and being the GOAT, I mean, that leads us to one other person that, of course, we have to mention on the show, even though he left and went to Tampa Bay. I think Tom Brady is the GOAT for exactly that reason. He isn't the most physically gifted, but intellectually he's gifted, and he has a work ethic that compares to none, and it makes him the GOAT for that reason. And it doesn't upset me that you say Michael Jordan, because one thing actually, as I've grown up and since I read Ayn Rand, and, you know, since I found objectivism in my mid-20s, is I can appreciate, you know, maybe not the Yankees or the Jets, but I can appreciate greatness from other organizations. As a Clemson fan, you know, I went to Clemson. That's where I know Dr. Thompson from. He's the director of the Clemson Institute of Capitalism there, or the institute. I don't know the exact name anymore, but I should hate Alabama by all means, right? We have this rivalry with them, but you know what? I like Alabama. I think they play good football. I appreciate Nick Saban, and I appreciate the high quality that they bring, their high quality of execution. I have even learned, and Celtics fans, don't get mad at me, I have learned through my fiance to appreciate who Kobe Bryant was. Is he the GOAT? No, but five championships and all the success he has, and when you read about Mamba mentality and all of that, there's a lot to appreciate there. And this leads to something I've seen people argue before, and I'm interested in your perspective on this. I think I know what your answer is going to be, but I'd like to hear what you think. People who say that, like, adults who wear other adults' jerseys, you know, if you were to put on a Tom Brady jersey or you were to put on a Jordan jersey, that's unhealthy. Because, you know, that's another adult. Who are you to make yourself lower than another adult? What do you think of that? Is that healthy or unhealthy?
I think the criticism is false. I mean, I think it certainly can be healthy. And, you know, and before I answer your question, I just will preface it by saying, yeah, Kobe Bryant had a tremendous work ethic. I have great respect for him. I have a long time antipathy for the Lakers. But, you know, you try and be honest and objective here. You know, salute Kobe Bryant's work ethic, not just because of the tragedy of his early death and the tragedy of his daughter, who was so talented, also as a basketball player, dying so young. But I had tremendous respect for Kobe Bryant's work ethic. Tom Brady, I think, is without a doubt the greatest quarterback who ever lived, maybe the greatest football player who ever lived. I think you could make a case for Jim Brown or Jerry Rice, but Tom Brady certainly in the discussion. Also, yeah, tremendous work ethic, absolutely off the charts. This is how you get to be the GOAT, you know? So, yeah, I think, you know, for adults, if I'm going to walk around with a Tom Brady jersey or a Michael Jordan, you know, jersey, or, you know, as a lifelong Yankee fan, I could, you know, wear the jersey of Babe Ruth or, you know, Lou Gehrig or Joe DiMaggio or Mickey Mantle or Reggie Jackson or Derek Jeter or some of these guys. You know, what you're saying is if you're wearing, you know, your Michael Jordan or your Larry Bird jersey or whatever, is I have great admiration for these guys. And I think we should have great admiration for them. Like I said, no matter first of all, we can properly admire when somebody has gifts. We shouldn't be envious just because somebody is smarter than us or physically better coordinated or stronger than us or better looking or, you know, or anything like that. We can admire gifts. Yeah, we often do with beautiful women, right? We can admire Angelina Jolie. And also, you know, beautiful women very often work at it. You know, Angelina Jolie and, you know, Julia Roberts and people like, they work at it. They exercise. They eat a good diet. You know, they can't take care of themselves to maintain their beauty. And athletes, you know, Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, Tom Brady, all these guys, you know, tremendous work ethic. Yeah, we should admire them. Wear their, you know, for sports fans, wear their jerseys. The criticism is unfounded. The rational part of it was what Charles Barkley said many years ago. It was another, you know, great player. Barkley said the athletes shouldn't be role models. Parents should be role models. Now, that's half true. Parents should be the main role models for children. Doesn't mean that athletes, but Barkley's wrong on the other hand. Doesn't mean that athletes can't be role models. Just because parents should be the main role models doesn't mean that athletes shouldn't be. And certainly as adults, we could continue that, you know, and greatly admire and, you know, and even hero worship these great athletes who work so hard to become so great at what they do.
I think that's a good point. I think there's kind of a war on admiration. And what I mean by that is there's this, you're supposed to feel guilty about admiring these great people, right? Like they should be guilty because they're great, but then you should feel guilty for admiring them. Could you talk a little bit about what an anti-hero is and sort of like why, you know, why we see that so often in our culture when we're so against this like admiration?
Yeah, that's a good question. Anti-hero is largely a literary, you know, artistic phenomenon in literature, you know, in novels, drama, film. It's the idea that and it's not a good name. Anti-hero makes it sound like they're opposed to heroes, you know, as if they were villains. And it shouldn't be non-hero or, you know, human haplessness. It's the idea that an individual is basically weak. You know, you can't accomplish great goals and you're probably going to be crushed by a dysfunctional family or, a brutal society. You can't win the battle against evil or oppression in any form, whether it's family, the state, or both. Human beings are basically weak and hapless. At a popular level, Woody Allen, you know, for many years, you know, made great commercial success out of being, you know, coming out as this neurotic, having the neurotic Jewish mother who dominated him, and he couldn't overcome whatever the guilt, you know, that he was riddled with. And serious literature abounds with this. I mean, Willie Loman in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, right? Famous play. Even his name, Loman, Lowman. You know, he's crushed. It's basically an anti-capitalist play. He's crushed by the capitalist system. And, you know, modern literature just is filled with these stories about these poor hapless guys who just can't get it together. They can't do anything with their lives. And I think it's a development of modern philosophy, modern intellectual culture. There's two tributaries that come together to form this river of anti-heroism. One is Marxism, the idea that, you know, the society is powerful, the individual is weak, the individual is molded by society, by the state, and above all, the capitalist system is evil. So you get all these anti-capitalists. You know, I mentioned Arthur Miller. John Steinbeck's Dust Bowl novels, you know, these guys are crushed. These migrant workers, there's no opportunities for them. They're disrespected. The capitalist system is just, there's no place for them in it. You know, there's the Marxist version is one. And then there's the Freudian version. You know, I mentioned Woody Allen as a popular example. You come out of crazy families and you just have all this angst. And you just can't overcome it. The interesting thing about the Freudian version is, you know, yeah, Freud talks about all these neuroses and everything. And Freud's crazy, by the way, as best I can understand. But he is a pioneer in the field of clinical psychology. And even though psychology is not my field, but clinical psychologists today, you know, psychotherapists generally I think that most of them generally reject Freud's theories, but they also generally respect him as a pioneer. Freud believed that through, you know, psychotherapy of various psychoanalysis, in this case, that we could achieve mental health. It's funny, the literary types never picked up on that. They just picked up on the fact that people are sick, they're crazy, they come out of dysfunctional families and so on. And you don't get enough stories about real heroes who may well have come out of crazy families and engaged in years of psychotherapy, you know, perhaps to, you know, recover their mental health. I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, Hannah Green's book, autobiographical, was that kind of a story, how she overcame, you know, severe mental illness to reclaim her mental health and go on to live a fulfilled life. That's heroic. Well, you don't see much. You don't see much. You get the crushed by the crazy family part, not the individual making the choice to go into AA or drug counseling or go cold turkey or go into psychotherapy and rise above the sick family and go on and live a real fulfilled and happy life. You don't see nearly as much of that. So the anti-hero mentality is dominant in intellectual culture, and you see in popular culture that millions of people are starved for the sight of heroes, which is why superhero movies, you know, are so popular.
Well, right. And when you talk about superhero movies and you talk about mental health and you talk about anti-heroes, that immediately draws me to Deadpool. And it makes me wonder, we conventionally consider him an anti-hero. That's what they've said. But from everything you're saying, he almost sounds like a hero, because he's going through all this suffering. You know, he gets cancer, so he gets this treatment, and it messes with him mentally, but it gives him superpowers. And then he goes about, it seems to me, acting heroically, right? He starts defending his values at that point. And we see this to a lesser extent with someone like Han Solo, too. We never really got his backstory before that shitty prequel they tried to do. But even Han Solo seemed to be psychologically tormented, but he was a stronger hero to me than Luke Skywalker was.
Yeah, absolutely right. Both characters, take them one at a time. Neither of them are anti-heroes. They're not hapless. That's the characteristic of an anti-hero. He's just kind of feckless. The anti-hero's weak. He lacks, really, should be a non-hero, should be the right name. He lacks the heroic characteristics. Now, Deadpool is either a hero or a villain, depending on what iteration we're talking about. You know, but he's way too powerful and efficacious to be considered an anti-hero or a non-hero. So yeah, he has these superpowers, and I don't know the whole comic book history. I was a big Marvel Comics fan when I was a kid, but I moved away from comic books by the time Deadpool was introduced. But I just, you know, doing a little research on it, it looks like he did some pretty bad things, you know, in some iterations or some versions of his character. So he might have been a villain at some point, but he's definitely not a weakling, you know, which is what the characteristic of anti-heroes is. And he becomes a hero later on in the saga, right, and in the movie. So yeah, I agree with you. Deadpool is a hero. A tormented hero, troubled hero, maybe mixed case, you know, morally flawed hero, perhaps at a real serious level. You know, in my book, I discussed Thomas Jefferson as a morally flawed hero. I think he's a hero. He's got serious flaws, but I think he's a hero. And we could discuss that if you want. But yeah, Han Solo to me is definitely a hero. You know, again, maybe, you know, tormented by these things, but he does all these great feats of daring do. And heroes not only have, you know, this great capacity, this prowess, but they put it in service of human life. And so Han Solo is fighting the bad guys. He's fighting the Empire, you know, in service of the Republic, in service of freedom, in service of human life. So he's definitely, and he's doing it very well. So he's definitely a hero.
Why do you think that we call these heroes anti-heroes in our common culture? Because that's what I hear all the time, is that, you know, Deadpool's an anti-hero, Han Solo's an anti-hero. Characters of that type are called anti-heroes. Is that just people not understanding the term? Or is there something more insidious going on with the way they're using that term? Are they trying to call heroes non-heroes on purpose?
Yeah, I think it's an element of both. I think with the rank and file, film goers, you know, popular book readers, I think it's just a lack of understanding. The intellectuals who push that mentality, they used to call James Bond an anti-hero. And I think it's part of trying to undermine our commitment, our understanding of what a hero is and our commitment and, you know, admiration for heroes. So James Bond, this goes back to, you know, 1960s when mm-hmm. Real Cold War. I was reading the James Bond novels when I was a kid in the 1960s growing up. It was Cold War, of course, but more important, he was a real hero. Now, so why would they, even at a superficial glance, why would anybody consider James Bond an anti-hero? I guess the mentality is that a hero, you know, has certain Boy Scout kind of qualities. He does all that is good, but he's not chasing skirt, you know, and he's not partying, you know, and everything. He's very, very straight arrow kind of guy. Loves the heroine, and stuff. And James Bond was something of a womanizer, you know. There was a beautiful woman in every novel, and the ladies all liked him, and he was having sex with all these different, you know, beautiful babes and everything. So if you come with a real straight arrow Boy Scout Christian kind of religious kind of mentality for what a hero is, James Bond doesn't match that. But even personally, I don't have any problem with James Bond having a different woman in every book. But even if I did, I would abstract away from that. So, okay, there's a flaw, let's say. I don't think it is, but if I did, it's a minor flaw. I mean, he saves the world from all these monsters. He saves the world from communists. He saves the world from, you know, from Spectre, all these brutal, murderous villains. And I'm going to object to him having a different girlfriend in every story? I mean, that's ridiculous. It's an attempt to undermine, you know, our appreciation of, you know, of heroes. And, you know, Deadpool and Han Solo, same thing. They do a lot of daring do in service of the good. They're not harming or killing innocent people. The guys that are taking out are bad guys who are victimizing innocent people. So they're promoting human life, which I think is critical characteristic of heroes. And they have certain flaws, but they're relatively minor compared to the heroic daring do. And I think the intellectuals don't want us to have an understanding of or appreciation for heroes. And so they try and minimize the heroic stature. They can't call them villains, so they call them anti-heroes.
Yeah, so you've mentioned Jefferson a few times. We should really talk about that. I mean, we've seen, you talk about tearing down heroes. You know, we're seeing people tear down statues, and Jefferson's been one of the ones that they've been attacking pretty heavily. Like, how should we look at the historical figure of Jefferson? And, you know, should we all run out and start tearing down Jefferson's statue because he's not a hero?
Well, I think Jefferson is a hero, even if he's a morally flawed hero. I think we should build more statues. So a couple of points here. First of all, you know, there's an attempt to label the founders as racist and slave owners, you know, and that's partly false. I mean, the Northern founders were all abolitionists. We were talking before about Brad Thompson, Justin, at the Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism. You know, and Dr. Thompson, you know, is an expert on, you know, on John Adams and the America's revolutionary period. And Adams, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, who freed his own slaves and became an abolitionist, Thomas Paine, these guys were all abolitionists. The Virginians, of course, were slave owners. You know, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Henry, they were all slave owners. Although theoretically, you know, Jefferson was an abolitionist, he just never put it into practice, and we could criticize him for his hypocrisy. So you know, Jefferson was definitely a slave. Well, he may have been a racist. He thought, I think he did, at least at some time in his life, thought that blacks were intellectually inferior to whites. Probably didn't prevent him from having a romantic relationship for years with Sally Hemings, who he never freed. So Jefferson's is a real mixed case. On the one hand, you know, the bad news is slave owner, probably a racist, never freed his slaves, even at his death, never freed Sally Hemings, who was probably his lover and probably the mother, you know, of some of his children. Serious flaw. And then, of course, during the vicious political party wars of the 1790s, if you read Joseph Ellis's book, Founding Brothers, he's very good on this. I mean, Jefferson just hired scandal mongers to write all these lies that he knew were lies about his former buddy, John Adams, and then denied culpability. I mean, he's... Joseph Ellis, a very good writer, put it nicely. He said Jefferson conducted an artful minuet with duplicity. How's that? How's that for a way with words? An artful minuet with duplicity. So, you know, Jefferson had serious moral flaws. But at the same time, we can't overlook the fact that he was the lead author of the Declaration of Independence. He was an early advocate for American independence from Great Britain. He strongly supported religious freedom. He strongly encouraged, he was U.S. ambassador in France when Madison, his buddy Madison, was writing, you know, the Constitution, strongly endorsed a Bill of Rights, you know, for the U.S. Constitution, established the University of Virginia, but it was a great scholar who defended freedom of the mind, right? Declared eternal hostility to any form of tyranny over the mind of man, donated his vast book collection to establish the Library of Congress. These are heroic deeds. I think, you know, just being the lead author of the Declaration of Independence alone, as well as being such a strong supporter of religious freedom, which is revolutionary, never mind in the 1780s, it's revolutionary today, you know, like in the Arab Islamic world. Religious freedom is. So I think Jefferson is a hero. He's a morally flawed hero. And I think we have to, I think rational hero worship is one, we acknowledge his flaws. Two, we deplore them. And then three, by a process of selective focus, by a process of abstraction, we focus on the towering achievements in the field of personal liberty that Jefferson is responsible for. And I think what justifies such a focus is Ayn Rand's point that we rewarding the good, recognizing and rewarding the good is more important than fighting the evil, because it's the good that makes human life possible, and the good is that which promotes human life. And Jefferson did an enormous amount of good, and we need to salute him and celebrate him, even though for being the hero that he is, even though we deplore his moral flaws, it's not just errors, we all make errors, but his moral failings. You know, we recognize that, we deplore it, but we focus on the enormous life-giving achievements. That's why I think Thomas Jefferson is a morally flawed hero, but to me, he's indubitably a hero.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. The thing that bothers me about all this tearing down of statues and heroes in general is that if you require this kind of moral, by tearing down these people and saying that they're not heroic because they own slaves, let's just pick that one example, you make it impossible for certain people who otherwise could see themselves as being heroic, like that heroism is possible even if you have these moral flaws, right? So you sort of like take a bunch of people out of being able to do good, right? You disarm them to take these heroic actions and to feel inspired and say, you know, I may have these moral flaws, but I can still achieve great good, right? And you sort of take that off the map when you say, well, we require this sort of Platonic moral perfection. Forget like even backwards historical moral perfection, right? Like saying, well, they didn't follow the morality of today, so clearly they were imperfect and no longer heroes. It seems very destructive and psychologically unhealthy to me as well.
Well, yeah, William, I think Jefferson was even aware of that himself. I mean, he said that slavery was a blot on what they had created, and he said it was another generation's problem to solve. So I think he had that awareness of it too.
Yeah, he was a lifelong abolitionist in theory. And right. he favored slow emancipation of the slaves in a way that wouldn't, you know, plunge the nascent republic into the horrors of civil war. And in that regard, he was prescient. He realized slavery was evil. He realized slavery contradicted everything the country was founded on. He realized slavery was going to tear the country apart. And he was right. You know, he was right about that. You know, led directly to the Civil War, was the, you know, by far the bloodiest war in American history. So, you know, he was right. He was right about that.
So I want to return to something you said in a previous question, because I want to lead up to sort of talk about the stories we tell nowadays, and especially with the superhero stories we're telling nowadays. You said a couple times, you know, that heroes work in service of the good or in service of human life. Could you unpack that a little bit and say what you mean by that? Because I think that people hearing that could bring their own preconceptions to those statements. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. About self-sacrifice and, you know,
right.
And such. Yeah. There's a couple of points. I agree, you know, agree entirely with Ayn Rand here. And if people haven't read her novels, I strongly recommend they read The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. In a way, for, you know, people who haven't read Ayn Rand's novels yet, in a way I envy them because they, you know, they have the opportunity for the unrepeatable intellectual emotional experience of reading The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged for the first time. So, you know, strongly recommend that. But, you know, Ayn Rand argues that human life is the standard of moral value, and taking action that, you know, taking action in to promote life, you know, life advancing goals, whether you want you're trying to get an education, or you want a productive career, or you want a healthy relationship with a, you know, with an honest man or woman as friends or as lovers. These are things that promote human life: education, productive career, healthy relationships with, you know, honest friends, you know, romantic partners. These are all things that promote human life. They're not harming, you know, they're not harming human life. They're not, you know, violent criminal actions, for example. So heroes always put their prowess, you know, in service of the good, in service of human life. But yeah, the term service could be misconstrued. Well, let's say they use their prowess to promote human life or to advance human life, but it's always in support of their, maybe in support of human life, but it's always in support of their own values. So, George Washington, for example, you know, risks his life. Well, the Continental Army, the soldiers, you know, we talk about, is a good example, I guess, is Valley Forge. You know, we talk about the sacrifices made because, like, thousands of American soldiers died at Valley Forge from malnutrition or from exposure to, you know, to the brutal weather conditions. You know, that's what people who advocate self-sacrifice mean when they talk about the sacrifices our ancestors have made. But what we need to recognize is that these men were animated by an ideal, you know, what they call the spirit of 76. And by the way, Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence was, he was the lead author, not the exclusive author. But the DOI was a tremendous inspiration to, you know, to many of the soldiers in the Continental Army. They were fighting for their values, you know, for their freedom, for the freedom of their family members, for the freedom of the people they loved, for the freedom of the nascent republic that they loved. They were fighting for values. It's, you know, what Ayn Rand means by selfishness, and again, I agree with her, is acting in support of rational, life-affirming values. So, you know, if I risk my life to defend my, you know, my daughter's life, and maybe even lose it, it's not an action that involves a sacrifice of my values. It's action taken to protect, you know, a cherished value, my daughter's life. And so, similarly, in service of, you know, defending my freedom or my family's freedom or the freedom of the country I love, these actions are value laden. They're value driven. Heroes never surrender their values. They never sacrifice what's dear or holy to them. Rather, they'll stand up for their values. They'll stand up for what's most important to them. So they're not sacrificing. The actions are self-fulfilling, not self-sacrificing.
So
one point I made in the book is it's not necessarily a sacrifice to surrender your life, but it's always a sacrifice to surrender the values that add meaning to your life. So if I surrender freedom, you know, for these soldiers, surrender freedom and then live under the tyranny of the king, that's a sacrifice. Because surrendering my freedom and the freedom of the people I love. But if I stand up and fight for it, even if I die for it, that's action in promotion of rational, life-affirming values and my own values. Those actions are value-driven and value-laden, not value-surrendering or value-sacrificing.
So you went exactly where I was going to go. You basically read my mind. Is in our stories, and especially in our superhero stories, we have this idea that our culture has this idea that if a superhero dies or a superhero risks his or her life, that's acting sacrificially. That's acting for the greater good. The sort of writer, I don't know if you know Frank Miller. He was really big in the 80s, really influential. He's an objectivist. He said something really interesting, right? He wrote The Dark Knight Returns. He wrote 300. He had some other arcs that were very popular. And he said something really interesting. You know, he was talking about this idea of the heroic death. And I think it sort of flies in the face. And I really wanted to hear what you have to say about it. He talked about Leonidas in 300, you know, the 300 die, right? They're fighting the Persians. They die. And he said that Leonidas died knowing that his dying, his sacrifice, quote unquote, was the only way to make sure his values lived on past him. And then he had a quote about when he realized about this storytelling arc. I tend to be drawn to characters who might die disgraced to the world, who technically lose whatever combat they're in, but win the moral victory. Why do you think it is that we have this idea that dying is always altruistic and always sacrificial, and that's how to be a hero, when sometimes, a lot of times, the heroic thing is dying to protect your values, and that's what makes it heroic?
Right, right. Well, you can see why at a popular level, you know, people would need to have an interest in moral philosophy in order. I think most people have the intelligence to do it. Whether they have the sufficient interest in moral philosophy to dig into these issues is the question. At a superficial glance, certainly somebody, you know, firefighters run into a burning building to save the lives of innocent people who are strangers and perhaps die, you know, tragically sometimes. In that attempt, you could see why at a superficial glance, your people might regard that as a sacrifice. But the deeper issue here for such heroes, and this is certainly heroic, is even with strangers, you know, human life is of value. And some people might say, well, it's their job. They get paid to do this. Well, that's true. But they chose this job, you know, as distinct from the other jobs they might have chosen. And you know, I would think that innocent human... Look, people are presumed innocent until unless proven guilty. So the presumption here is that people in this burning building are innocent. Innocent human life is a tremendous value. You know, I'm willing to risk my life. You know, the firefighter is, I'm willing to risk my life, you know, to save innocent human lives. It's that much of a value to me. And so the interesting thing I think we need to point, and certainly true, you know, when you're risking your life for family members, you know, for the man or woman you love, for the child, you know, for the child you love, I think a lot of people get it when you talk about risking your life for your child, a lot of parents would do that because, and not regard it as a sacrifice, because the child's life is of such monumental value to me. And I think the point we need to make here, and that people often miss out, is that people who are willing to risk their life, whether it's for their child or their lover or even for strangers, like with the firefighters, people willing to risk their life lead meaningful lives. Their lives are filled with meaning. These people are so important to me that I'm willing to risk my life for them. It shows that their lives aren't empty. They have values, you know, that they're willing to risk their life for, or even die for. And it makes their lives meaningful. And I think that, you know, that's very self-fulfilling. And again, it should be saluted and admired.
Yeah, 100%. And last thing here, I didn't have this like in our outline or anything, but you keep talking about family members and lovers and everything, and it really, really makes me think of one of my favorite movies. I don't know, have you ever seen Batman versus Superman?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Well, in that movie, before Superman dies, before, you know, he doesn't know he's going to die, right? He's going into battle. And before he does, he tells Lois, he says, "This is my world. You are my world." And then he goes into battle. To me, that's exactly what you just said. And you even just put a finer point on it and made me appreciate the movie almost on another level I hadn't thought of before. Just the amount of meaning he has in his life, that he loves someone so much that he's willing to put himself in danger. And in that moment, he's realizing that's what he's fighting for, and that's why he's alive. That's what gives his life meaning. I mean, do you think that line, do you agree with me that line shades that meaning there, and it's not an altruistic sacrifice that he's, you know, doing it in service of and protection of the good that he sees?
Absolutely. It's what heroes do. And with, you know, I was always much more of a Marvel guy than a DC guy. Although the character of Batman always fascinated me. But like, you know, one thing that always, even as a kid, that stuck in my craw about DC is that, you know, Clark Kent, you know, puts on a pair of glasses and then people don't recognize that he's the same guy as Superman. I mean, come on. I mean, it's just lame, you know. But anyway, but that's a detail. Yeah, I mean, superheroes, first of all, they care about innocent human life. It's just like, you know, being a freedom fighter. You're fighting for your own freedom, and you're fighting for the freedom of the family you love, but you're fighting also for the freedom, you know, of people in the United States or whatever country you're fighting for. You care about innocent human life. It matters to you. It means you have a lot of brothers and sisters. All the good people in the world are your brothers and sisters. And even if you don't know them, they're potential friends, they're potential allies, they're potential lovers. You know, it adds tremendous meaning to your life. And then on top of that, when you're in a profound romantic relationship, like Clark Kent, you know, Superman is with Lois Lane, how much he loves her and she loves him, gives you even an added incentive, you know, to fight for the good. You're fighting for her. You're fighting for the woman you love, whose role in your life, whose place in your life. It's tremendous value and tremendous meaning in your life. You're fighting for values. You're fighting for, in a way, for the meaningfulness of your own life. And it's very, very self-rewarding and self-fulfilling. We shouldn't, very heroic, because it's in pursuit of your own values, and your values are good, your values are life promoting. And we shouldn't sully it or taint it by saying it's a sacrifice. A sacrifice means you're giving up your values, and you know, hero would ever surrender their values.
Well, I think that is a great place to end this interview. I'm pumped up right now. I'm inspired. I feel positive. I want to go find all the other people who are good people and make the world a better place. So why don't we sum up this entire episode, tie a bow on it, put a point on it. What did we learn this trip into the Midside? Andy, if you want to go first.
Well, in the first half of the show, we learned that there's a lot of insanity in the world, and vicious insanity. And I think we could integrate it with the second half of the show, is that heroes stand up for the good, and we need to stand up against the insanity and speak out in any form open to us. We certainly could do it privately with friends, neighbors, colleagues, family members. And today, in effect, every man has a platform. Social media gives us a platform, even though, you know, Facebook may sometimes shut you down. I mean, Facebook has never shut me down. You know, and I stand up for individual rights and capitalism and Ayn Rand's novels and philosophy all the time. I do it in rational and respectful ways, not abusive ways. If that's the case, then we all have a platform. We can use Facebook and Twitter and, you know, various social media to reach out to the world. But in any form open to us, public or private, we need to stand up, you know, and support freedom, individual rights, colorblind individualism, oppose all forms of racism, and speak out. We need to have the courage to speak out. It's what heroes do.
William, what did you learn this trip?
I learned that rather than tearing down Thomas Jefferson statues, we should be building more of them. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
Well, I'm going to do the first half, second half thing that Andy just did, because I really liked it. And in the first half, I learned that a better way of portraying and talking about defund the police is to call it criminals lib. I really like that, because that's 100% what it is. And we've seen that even with coronavirus, where we're like, there's a pandemic, we need to let prisoners out of jail. What? That doesn't make any sense. And in the second half, I actually have and I didn't even think this was possible, but I have a deeper appreciation of Batman versus Superman now, that the whole movie is about the world doubting Clark's heroism and portraying him as a villain, which is something, you know, Andy talked a lot about with our whole idea of calling people like Deadpool and Han Solo anti-heroes. So they're basically calling him a villain, but he still has the strength and the integrity to fight for his values at the end of the movie. That makes the movie even more heroic, and I appreciate it on an even deeper level now. So, wow. Wow. All right, I want to thank Andy. I want to thank you for coming on the show. And if you want to plug anything, now's the time. If you want to plug your book, tell people where to find it. And if you want to give them the opportunity to reach out to you.
Here's a copy of Heroes, Legends, Champions, Why Heroism Matters. You can certainly get it from Amazon. Go on my website, which is just andrewbernstein.net. And my Patreon page is linked to my website if you want to help support, you know, my values and the work I do. I greatly appreciate it. The website is just andrewbernstein.net. And I want to thank Justin and William. Thanks for having me on the show. It was great.
Yeah, it was wonderful having you on. I think, as I said, you know, during the week and in the pre-show, I think what you said fits in perfectly with what we're doing here in the Midside. So we loved having you on. And I want to thank, as always, everyone for listening. Anyone who listens to the show, it's great that you share our values and you enjoy what we're doing. We really appreciate that. Our Liberty.me listeners, where we're syndicated, we appreciate you libertarians. We may not agree 100% on everything, but we appreciate that we share those values. And I think we all have a life-affirming perspective. As always, if you want to get a t-shirt, you can go to themidside.com/store. As always, we said Patreon or locals. You can find those patreon.com/themidside, themidside.com/patreon, themidside.com/locals, themidside.locals.com. That helps us keep the lights on, keep this show going. And as always, the most important thing you can do is tell a friend. If you enjoyed this episode, just, you know, it's very easy to go on your podcast app and just click share and send that link to people. That's all you got to do. I do it. I send it to random people on Twitter. That's what I do. I find people talking about this stuff and I go, hey, you might like this. So appreciate if you did that. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Nemlinski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a heroic day.
Did the book ever arrive? I priority mailed it to you on Tuesday, and I was shocked when they said it wouldn't get there till Saturday.
I checked my mail yesterday. I never got anything.
Oh, my God.
But, I mean, so, did you send it USPS?
Yeah, priority mail.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen how in shambles the USPS is, right? It said they lost billions of dollars or something.
That was a story. I don't think it made it in this week, but there's already people claiming Trump is cutting the Postal Service in order to fuck with the elections. So
I saw that too.
We could joke about that.
Yeah, I went home and I realized they said Saturday delivery, 4 days. So if I better send Justin a digital copy, that was during the storm on Tuesday. I got home, my internet was down, so you know I didn't have access. And I left on Thursday morning to go lecture to a Tea Party event in Pennsylvania. I still didn't have internet, so I couldn't even send you a digital copy. But anyway, you'll get the hard copy soon enough. Maybe by Christmas, but eventually you'll have the hard copy.
Yeah, I'm excited either way because it sounds awesome. So I'm looking forward to reading it either way. I would have liked to have, you know, got a little more context for the episode, but it's still. Yeah, I was actually glad you brought it up because it actually fits in perfectly with what we talk about a lot in our art section on this show. So.